Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Each episode is a conversation with inspiring people who make wonderful contributions to our knowledge in these areas and spark curiosity and ideas to pursue. Join me, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
It's really just to know who you are, right? And to recognize that not everyone will like you or want to work with you. You know, I mentioned earlier that I'm a fast talker. Obviously, anyone listening to this has heard that. So there will be people who will say, wow, she talks way too fast. I can't keep up with that. And that's fine, right? Because the people who do like that will gravitate towards me, and the ones who don't will gravitate away. So be willing to embrace your strengths and your weaknesses, whatever they might be.
Hi there, innovator. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I trust too that you enjoyed my recent conversations with Joey Coleman, author of Never Lose a Customer Again, and with Sarah Anderson of Visibility Co. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Laura Briggs. She's a freelance writer and coach. Laura spent most of her life preparing to be an educator and then burned out after working as a middle school teacher. She started a freelance writing career on the side and quickly replaced, then surpassed her day job earnings and hit the six-figure mark in just 18 months. Since 2013, she's worked full-time for herself, helping clients with content and project management, and also working with digital teams. She now teaches others how to build fulfilling lifestyle businesses from home as a coach. Laura is also the author of Launch Your Own Freelance Writing Business and a two-time TEDx speaker. A quick promotional message from our sponsor, InnovaBiz, where we help coaches and consultants build professional credibility, engage their target audience, and connect with their ideal clients. Now, to help you get absolute clarity about who your ideal client is and how you can connect and communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship, take a look at our Marketing Master mini class, which you can access at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and even accessible without giving away your email. It's my gift to you for being one of our listeners on the podcast. In our discussion today, Laura talked to me about rapidly scaling up your business and how she went about that. We talked about building a virtual team as part of that scale-up process. And we talked about setting up your business with recurring revenue. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Laura Briggs. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today, all the way from St. Paul, Minnesota in the USA, Laura Briggs, who's a freelancing coach, author of Start Your Own Freelance Writing Business. She's a TEDx speaker and also host of the Advanced Freelancing podcast. So welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Laura. It's a great privilege to have you as my guest.
Oh, it's my honor to be here. So thank you.
Laura, you began your freelancing career as a writer and a content marketing strategist, and then you grew a six-figure business in just 18 months, and now you teach other freelance writers how to do that as well, so how to launch and grow their business, and you also do things like building systems and outsourcing and bringing virtual teams on board. So I'm really looking forward to exploring all those topics with you today, but before we get started talking about all things freelancing, writing and building teams and building a business. Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get to where you are today, and what were some of the pivotal moments in that journey?
I always thought that I was going to end up in education, either working as a secondary teacher or working as a professor. So I'd always loved communicating and connecting with people and sort of coaching and teaching them through things. But after working here in the United States public school system, I realized I did not want to be a teacher. I gained a great appreciation for what teachers do. I'll say that. So I really respect anyone who does that job, but I could not see me doing it for 20 or 30 years. So I started to look at all the different skill sets that I had, you know, what within the teaching job was I good at? What things had I always gravitated towards? And writing kept coming up over and over again. And there's a lot of stereotypes around writing that writers don't make any money. They're starving artists. You know, if you don't want to be paid at all and, you know, you want to be stressed out all the time, that's a great career. But I wanted to see if that was really true and see if there was any way to make money, especially in light of the fact that when I was going through this, it was sort of in the wake of the Great Recession. And I saw how much technology was changing things and how online marketing was really having a renaissance. And so there were all types of new content that people needed to have, websites and blogs and, you know, online email funnels. And so I thought there was a lot of potential there. And that's how I got started.
That's great. Yeah, I can relate to the teaching thing. I've got a long story, actually, but basically involves when I was choosing to go to university, pretty well heated debates in between my parents and I about me having to become a teacher. And I said, no, I don't want to be a teacher. Couldn't imagine anything worse. So I didn't need to go into the classroom and try it out. I remembered my experience as a student and felt for the poor teachers that we had.
Exactly.
Yeah. But the paradox, of course, is now we're all educating, aren't we?
Yes. So
writing and marketing, and of course you've got your courses. So
yeah, it kind of comes education. Yeah, it comes back full circle anyway. So that's why I was like, how do I change, you know, my career? I've always wanted to be a teacher of some sort, and now it's like I'm back into teaching, but in a different way than I expected.
So how did you get started working for yourself then? How did you, that journey of building that six-figure business in 18 months get started?
Well, I worked with a lot of clients on one-time projects first. I started thinking about what would be easiest for me to learn. Certain types of writing, like creating white papers, writing books, writing sales copy, they take a long time to learn and they have their own strategies behind that. So I looked for what would have the shortest learning curve. And for me, that was blogs and website content. Things that are only about one page long of typed text. I knew that I would be able to teach myself the tactics behind how to do that faster than, say, learning how to write and edit a book. So I jumped in, you know, the world of freelancing with what was going to be simplest for me. And then I went from there and I realized that one of the cool things about blogs is that a lot of people need them every single month. And so I had a lot of clients that were hiring me, not just for a one-time project, but sort of ongoing. And I started to realize, hey, if I hire the right people and I charge fair rates and they're working with me for 3 months or longer, one of my clients has been with me, having me on retainer for 6 years now, I saw the potential to be able to plan my income and know where my business was going.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, so there's a really good point there about how to structure your services in a way that it generates recurring, predictable income, which is always something that will help your business, put your business on a stable footing. So you talked about hiring the right people. So when did you take that step of bringing people on board to help you and basically move from being the technician or the person that does everything in your job to starting to act like a business owner and building a team?
Well, as anyone who runs a business knows, a business owner wears a lot of different hats. And the reality is we shouldn't be doing a lot of the tasks that we do at the beginning. When you start your own business, you're the chief technical officer, chief financial officer, VP of marketing, you're everything, right? And so it's hard to let go of that control. But I realized that a lot of the administrative tasks inside my business, they weren't the best use of my time, but I also wasn't any good at them. You know, I didn't know anything about social media scheduling. So that really shouldn't be something that I should be doing. That should be passed off to my team. And so I started to see little tasks here and there where it made sense for me to pull that off my plate and give that to a virtual assistant, for example. So for me, I'm not a graphic designer and I am terrible with any type of graphic design. So that saves me a lot of frustration as well as headaches and just coming up with something really ugly if I could just hire that out to the right person. And so I started with that, different types of tasks that I really didn't enjoy doing. It might take me 5 or 6 hours to put together a PowerPoint slide deck, but my virtual assistant can do it in 30 minutes because we already have the template created and I just give him the text outline. So that's a great example of when it makes more sense for someone else to take over the task.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. It's having somebody who's got specialized expertise and who can do it more effectively and more efficiently, turn it over quicker, but also allow you then to spend your time on the things that you add most value to the business and to your clients.
Yes, you have to learn where your zone of genius is. For me, that is talking to clients to convert them and then doing the actual writing on their projects. But there's a lot of other pieces in that: proofreading, sending out invoices, doing some of the marketing, like posting my own blog. That doesn't necessarily have to be done by me. And so I look for opportunities like that to take it off my plate all the time.
So how did you get started building a team? Did you have people working for you locally, or are they remote? I know today you've got a lot of people working remotely.
I started remotely. I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to find someone in my local area who understood the types of things I was talking about. And given that I was a digital freelancer, I was sure that I could find somebody else who had expertise in these other areas. So I started off with what I call a general virtual assistant. It was sort of to get my feet wet with hiring and outsourcing, to see how it really worked, what things I needed to know going forward as far as procedures and contracts and training a new person on my team. And so I don't think I have ever worked with somebody in person. I have always worked with remote team members.
And what are some of the challenges you faced when you got started with that remote working? Because I know that, you know, a lot of people are really interested in having the remote working situation, particularly if they can hire people in countries where the cost of living and the cost of wages is a lot lower. But they find it very challenging for a whole range of reasons. So what were some of the challenges that you faced and how did you address those?
Well, one of the biggest challenges, and I see other business owners make this mistake all the time, is assuming that there's one person who can do all of the extra things on your to-do list that you don't. That person does not exist. And you're also not looking for someone who's a second version of you. You're looking for someone to fill the gaps where you can't be. So I don't really care if anyone on my team has any interest in blog writing or any skill in it. That's something I'm doing. I'm looking for different skill sets for them. So part of it is breaking it up to the right people. So for example, on my team right now, I have a virtual assistant who works on my podcast. She does all the show notes and the social media graphics. And then I have a different graphic designer who makes all of my other forward-facing images. And I have another VA who does a lot of research and putting together my PowerPoint slides. So they each work on tasks that they really enjoy and are good at. But that way, I'm not asking one person to handle too many things at once. So that's a big one and a common struggling point. Another one is, does it really make sense for you to hire somebody who's outside of your country or outside of your native language? There are situations where you can find great people to work for you all over the world, that's for sure. But sometimes, for example, if I'm going to have a virtual assistant who's going to send out LinkedIn messages on my behalf or something where they're kind of acting as me, I want to make sure we have a really good communication style between the two of us and that we mesh well in terms of personality. And so hiring the cheapest person is not always the best solution for your business, especially if you kind of expect them to get up to speed right away. And then you have to go back and redo all the work anyways. You haven't saved money there. You've lost money because now you're back doing the same tasks and you have to start from square one hiring again. So I try to hire for the right person for the job, even if they're not necessarily the cheapest.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I think people make that mistake often as they get started and they think, well, we can only afford somebody that is working in another country who is going to be a lot lower in cost than our local country, but then they focus too much on that cost thing rather than, as you point out, the quality and also the match.
Yeah. Good people are hard to find too. And so you want to know the type of personality you're trying to hire for. As a freelancer myself, I don't want my team members to ever feel that they're being micromanaged, because that's something I don't like as a business owner and freelancer. So I look for people who have a certain type of personality. I don't care when they do the work, just as long as they get it done and it gets turned in on time. And so I tend to attract other freelancers who are like me. So think about that too. You know, are you the type of person who needs regular communication and check-ins? You don't want to hire the type of freelancer like me who prefers to do a lot of their work on their own and only check in occasionally. So always be thinking about that when you're hiring someone too.
Yeah, that's a great point as well. So, I mean, when we hire people, we look first of all at cultural fit, but then, as you say, the work style is really important. And to me, that's part of the cultural fit, but it certainly makes a big difference when you've got somebody that works according to your own style. So they, for example, don't like to be micromanaged either, and they're quite independent and they make decisions on their own within a framework. So that's really good. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, in terms of the writing, so tell us a little bit about your process for putting together a blog post, for example.
Sure. So it can be complicated or not complicated, depending on who I'm working with as a client. Some clients know exactly what they want, and they just say, I don't have the time, the interest, or the ability to complete this. But more clients today are recognizing that they need to have some type of content, and they don't know where to start. So I've noticed that in the last year or so, I've done a lot more in terms of content strategy. So, okay, let me go out and do the research for you. What are your competitors writing about? What trends and studies are happening in your industry that we should have commentary on to position you as a thought leader? What, you know, keywords are we looking for to potentially help rank your website in search engines? And also, I am pushing more companies too to have a really good customer avatar. You know, who are they trying to reach? And I very much try to get in the mindset of that person. What has this person gone through to Google something and click on my client's link? I want to meet that person right where they're at, to kind of help them through the process and increase the chances that they'll feel that trusting relationship with my client's content.
Yeah, that's really great advice. It's something that we work on all the time, is getting really clear about who your ideal client is, who you're talking to when you're writing a blog post or whatever it might be that you're presenting. So it's wonderful advice. One of the things I'm curious about, what particular areas do you work in? And I guess the question behind that is, if there's a know-how involved in the content that you're putting together, how do you acquire that know-how, for example, in an effective and efficient way? And then how do you put that out in the voice of your customer?
So there are two primary ways that you can niche as a writer, and you can do one or you can do both. And that is by project type and then by client type. So as far as project type, most of the work that I do falls under the umbrella of blog and website content or email newsletters. And then I'm also niched for the vast majority of my projects by the type of client. I mostly work with attorneys and law firms here in the United States. Mm-hmm. I have had different types of clients all over the world, but it seems to come back to that common niche. And so I taught myself blog and website content writing using search engine optimization tactics, because I think most companies today are well aware that they need to at least be considering that in their content strategy. As we mentioned earlier, it's the potential for recurring revenue, because it's not a project they can hire me for one time and be done with it. It's usually more of a long-term project. And then with my clients that I work with, I try to think specifically about what their pain points are, what their challenges have been in hiring other freelancers. So not only am I niched by that SEO blog and website content, I can showcase my expertise with the type of copy, but I can also say, yes, I've worked with over 200 attorneys. So I know you, your pain points, your obstacles, the concerns that you have, the questions your kinds of clients ask. And that makes it easier for me to do my research and also for me to convert my clients.
Yeah, that's great advice. So a couple of important points there, I think, is niching down in the topic area where you start to build a expertise in the particular content and issues and challenges, and also what's going on in the industry. And then doing the research around what the readers look for? What do people searching for that service or product look for?
Yes, absolutely. And the more that as a writer or as any type of creative freelancer working on behalf of other people, the more you can understand them and their clients, the easier it will be to create material for those projects.
Hmm. Yeah. All right. Now, I mentioned at the start that you're now teaching other freelancers to build their own writing business, and you've got some courses online. So how did you kind of transition to that that part of the business, building courses and reaching that community? Because I'm guessing that that is a different client base.
It is. And it's interesting because I still kind of have my foot in each of these businesses. So I have to remember who I'm talking to with which channels, because it's very different to talk to attorneys versus millennial aspiring freelancers. And so that's an ongoing challenge. But a lot of it was just people kept asking me. People kept asking me for help. Well, hey, I heard your story. I'd like to be able to do what you do. How do you get started as a writer? How do you get paid as a freelancer? Where do you find clients? And for a long time, I tried to answer these people one-on-one, either over the phone or over email. And then I realized I can't keep up with this. I can't keep answering their questions in this way. So I'm going to build a community where people can get support, find resources, you know, share common stories and concerns. And that's really how I got started with doing courses. And now I do coaching with freelancers as well.
Hmm. So you built the community first based on lots of people asking questions, and then constructed the courses probably with some input from that community, I'm guessing.
Yes, that's probably my number one tip for building courses. Don't create the course first. See if it sells and pre-sell it. So I did this even with my most recent course. I said, I don't want to spend 30, 40 hours creating, recording, and publishing a new course if there's no interest in it. So I always like to say, hey, this course drops on a certain date. If you enroll now, you're going to get the special pre-launch price. That tells me if enough people buy it that I've got something on my hands that's worth creating. And then I'll just create it before the deadline. Or you can even drip that content out 1 week's worth at a time. And that has worked really well, because then I don't end up spending a lot of time on an unwanted course.
Hmm. Yeah. Now that is such valuable advice there. And if you take nothing else away from this episode, please remember what Laura's just said.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love doing that. So put together an outline, send it out to people, invite people to come and either on a special, as you're suggesting. What we often do is say, well, you know, you can be a beta tester or a foundation member, and you get to help construct the detail of the course and then bring people on board. And as you say, if nobody pays and shows interest, then you don't have to do the work.
Exactly. And then you also know too, it tells you a lot about your pricing and what you have in the course when you first launch it too. So if it sells really quickly to a lot of people, you'll know, hey, after this initial round, when I get the feedback and make it better, I can probably push the price of this course up because the demand for it was there.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So, and of course, the other thing we talked about earlier was recurring revenue. So your courses, so how do you structure those that gives you that recurring revenue? Is it kind of a time-limited course, or is it a community where there's membership involved on an ongoing basis?
So I have not built membership on an ongoing basis, just because I don't want to deal with any of the customer service emails. I'm like, if people have to, they're coming in and coming out at all the different times. I don't have that infrastructure in my team to manage that right now. So what I do is I focus on different courses for different parts of the year. Most of them are evergreen. And so if people opt into a certain freebie, they're going to go through a certain, you know, funnel that ultimately promotes that course at a great discount. Even if they don't buy, they're still on my email list. And so at various times throughout the year, I'll promote things that I feel are most relevant to, you know, the audience right now. So like for freelancers, one of the busy seasons is kind of like after the Christmas holidays around here in the United States. So from like January 20th on, there's a lot of business potential. So I might promote a product that helps people get their marketing in order or make sure that they have great work samples and a pitch to send out in the new year. So I try to time it like that. I also allow people to pay by payment plan so that there's money that's kind of coming in over an ongoing basis. It also expands your network to people who might not have that cash money up front to pay for the entire course as well. So that's usually how I do it. And then I also have sort of private coaching clients that I'm enrolling them in my various courses as it's a fit for them, but I'm working with them one-on-one and they are more of that sort of recurring revenue as well.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the top level of your echelon, if you like, in terms of the scale. So you've got courses where there's lots of people coming in through your funnels, and a lot of that is automated, I imagine. And then you've got your private coaching clients one-on-one where you've perhaps only got a small number.
Yes, absolutely. And so some of the, you know, less expensive products, people can still take them and make them work, right? Like my book, they can take the book and they could implement everything in the book and be successful. But some people need more accountability or more ongoing support. And so it's nice to have options where people can invest at different levels, because you might have someone who wants the do-it-yourself route, whereas someone else says, you know what, I need the accountability, I need the advanced support, and I'm willing to pay for that.
And in terms of the courses, how do you go about making sure that people have that accountability within the courses if they're doing the DIY route? How do you kind of ensure that they complete the course and that they get a result out of that? Because I think, you know, one of the downsides I see in a lot of online courses, and I've purchased courses myself where I've spent money, and some of them I haven't even started because there's just been so much stuff going on at the same time. And so in that sense, I'm a bad customer for that particular business, and potentially I'm also somebody that might actually speak badly about that business, but it's really my fault. So how do you deal with that kind of situation?
Well, there's a couple of different ways. So first of all, I don't offer any refunds on my digital products because I want to discourage anyone from buying it, maybe trying to download it and, you know, then request a refund after they have the key information. So what I tell people instead is email me to ask if you think you're a good fit. We'll have a conversation or we can discuss over email, you know, whether this course is right for you. There are times, there's been multiple times where I've told people, no, you don't need this. This course is too basic for you, or this course is too advanced. You're not quite there yet, or you really need one-on-one coaching, or you should just go read this other book by somebody else. So for me, that's a way to help prevent that. I've also learned that I have to have assignments built into the course, because without that accountability and people submitting their information, they're much less likely to be successful. And even with that, not everyone submits the homework, right? Like I have a course about how to use LinkedIn for freelancers. They get unlimited reviews of their LinkedIn profile. So as many times as they want to update it and send it to me and say, hey, is this right? Do you think I've got my keywords right, my tagline right? Well, only a handful of people have taken advantage of that. Now their profiles are better than the other students in the class, but it's that ongoing, you know, balance of how do I get people to do the work and to feel like there's, you know, enough to do here. And then the other part of it is I don't like courses that are very, very long. A couple of hours is the most that I can sit still in front of my computer to learn something. So I try to make sure that all of my courses are no longer than 3 to 4 hours. I think we've both probably purchased courses that were 9-10 hours long, and we've probably done nothing in those courses because it's just such a massive thing to think about.
That's
okay,
right, yeah.
Am I going to do this 1 hour at a time? Am I going to have one weekend where I barrel through it? You know, it's just overwhelming for people, and they shut down and psychologically check out.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of great advice in that. And I think one of the benefits of having the smaller courses also, if you can chunk it down and build course frameworks around modules that give people the opportunity to purchase another course to up their expertise, or if they don't, at least they've completed that one particular little module and they've gained experience or knowledge, or there's been some change for them as a result of that.
Yes, absolutely. And I think people too feel more confident in taking a course when they get a small win. So when there's something that they complete, even if they don't do all of the other things in the course, maybe they do one small assignment, you know, and that way they feel like, okay, I made forward momentum here. So if you can make your courses smaller, where it's very clear what the output is that the person's going to achieve, they now feel like, oh, it's possible for me to complete this course. It wasn't as hard as I thought. I got great feedback and finished the assignment or project. Now I'm ready to invest in the next piece of it.
That's right. Yeah. And that small win actually is almost a motivator for them to have a look, what else is there? And yes, I can have another small win here. It's not going to be the 7 or 8 hours that I have to invest and find time for. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's switch gears a little bit. So when did you start podcasting when did you start podcasting? Let's start with that.
So I started in 2017 and I podcasted for about a year. And then I took a really, really long break and I restarted my podcast 18 months after I quit, and then have been podcasting 6 months since that. So it's been an interesting journey having a drop in the middle there.
Yeah. So how have you found podcasting contributing to your business?
Well, it's interesting because I'm a writer, and so I always thought that I would connect with my ideal clients, whether they're attorneys or other freelancers who need courses or coaching, through the written word. But that is not the case. It's almost always video and audio. So for me, I'm always thinking about how can I be in front of my audience speaking, where they hear my personality. They know that I talk fast, so that's not a surprise to them if they hire me and we go into a strategy session and I'm going a million miles a minute. You know, I want them to know who I am, how I think, how I work, how I work through problems in my business. So it's interesting because I get messages like all the time from people saying, oh, I really loved this episode of your podcast, or I heard your podcast, I've been binging it. Someone sent me a message the other day that she'd listened to like 17 episodes in one weekend. And so I think it helps build that trust faster, right? Because they feel like they're a part of your world. And so that's the type of person who's probably most likely to reach out to me to hire me or to buy a course, because they're already, you know, like there's been nothing about me that has pushed them away yet. So they're already interested and, you know, kind of primed to discuss doing something further. And it's also perfect for me as a coach or as a course creator, because I see them as the person who gets things done. They're highly motivated and willing to do the work. And so that says to me, like, ding, 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 this is the right person to work with in one way or another.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So it's kind of like almost a filter as well.
Yes, absolutely. And so I also want my audience to feel like, you know, there's information and there's training and one-on-one support and customized advice that I reserve for my one-on-one coaching clients. But I don't want people to feel like they have no help or nowhere to turn because they don't have a budget, or they're just starting out, or coaching isn't right for them right now for whatever reason. And so I have a lot of things in my pipeline that are free or very, very affordable, with the idea being, if you are that DIY person, I don't want you to feel like the only way you can work with me is by paying for a 3-month expensive coaching package. Go ahead and go listen to my many podcast episodes on XYZ subject, or my interview on someone else's podcast where I talked about it. So I always want people to feel like they do have access to the information. It's more about what they choose to do with it.
Yeah, that's great. And how have you found writing for the podcast as opposed to writing for blogs?
Oh, it's different, you know, because I usually just create sort of rough outlines for my podcast episodes. And I am usually trying to walk people through a process, or even if I don't say it in the title, I'm thinking of like, what are the 5 things someone needs to know about this? So like, I just recorded a podcast episode about freelance contracts. So I talked about pitfalls in contracts and, you know, why most people avoid contracts and, you know, what you should never change in a contract, because I'm always thinking about it from that perspective. So I feel more freedom in the verbally spoken manner, because I don't have to be worried as much about search engine optimization or putting it in the right format where a person is going to scan it on a mobile phone. You know, you have to be mindful of those types of things with writing. And in the written or in the spoken word, it's more about how can you connect with this person who's maybe commuting to work, maybe only has 30 minutes or an hour, or they're on the treadmill or they're cleaning their house or doing something else, what value add can I bring to them during that time where you recognize that it might be different golden nuggets that you're leaving for somebody in different places. Different people will take different things from those episodes. So I've really enjoyed it.
All right. That's wonderful. Now, the other thing you mentioned that you do lots of speaking as well, and you've done a couple of TED Talks. So I'm curious, how did you land the TED Talks?
A lot of rejection. I think I was rejected 91 times before I received 5 invitations to speak. And so I applied a lot of different places. I sent a lot of demo reels and demo videos in. But ultimately, it was just about time and persistence. And I also tried to focus in all those applications on how I felt that freelancing and how much remote work and things like that are changing the economy and the workforce, they really hadn't been discussed on the TEDx stage to a great extent. There were maybe one or two other talks that briefly mentioned the gig economy, but I feel like it's especially having such a huge impact here in the United States, but really all over the world as well. And I felt my only regret is that I wish I'd known about freelancing sooner. And I thought this could be a way to have a really big platform to say, hey, there's this thing that's happening and there's going to be more of us freelancers here than traditional employees in the next 10 years. You know, have you heard of it? Do you know this is a legitimate career option? And so that's kind of how that came about.
Okay. Well, there's an interesting message in that. Well, it was a great message, I think, in terms of, you know, accept the rejections and don't give up. And I'm probably fine-tuning your pitches and messages yes. a little bit to see whether something will land.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of it is just the right people reading your information or viewing it at the right time. Organizers of TEDx events in particular are looking for a really good balance of different speakers. So they're not going to have like 8 business speakers at one event or 10 science speakers in an event. They're really looking for a variety. So you don't even have to take it personally when you get rejected. Your idea might not be a fit because maybe they've already brought on someone who has a similar sort of track to you. So keep working at it for sure.
Yeah. All right. Great advice. Now, in terms of, you talked about freelancing as a career option, and I know you spend quite a bit of time speaking to schools and universities to promote that message and kind of educate people that there is this other option than the traditional, you know, finish school, go to university, take some sort of course and then follow a career path in the corporate world that is a logical progression from there, which I think, you know, that was when I was growing up and going through university was the standard thing. I think it still is. And yet, as you say, there's so many other things that have changed in terms of technology and the internet and the opportunities that all that provides. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing there in terms of educating people on those other options.
Well, I think for a long time, and I still think it's true to a great extent, people view things like freelancing or remote work as unstable or not a real job, right? And that's not true. So I think we need to kind of flip the script on what people think these different career options are. More than ever today, employees and creative professionals and others who would fall under that umbrella of freelancers, they're looking for a career or business that suits their lifestyle and not kind of cramming in their lifestyle around any extra hours they have. So sometimes that means people are willing to take a pay cut or to take the risk of running their own business as a freelancer in exchange for the greater freedom that it affords. And I think even though we have more freelancers and remote workers in the economy than ever before, companies are still learning how to work with them effectively. So I kind of take a two-pronged approach to when I'm speaking about freelancing. I talk about how companies can hire, train, and onboard freelancers and remote workers the right way. And then I also talk to the freelancers about how to be successful in this new economy, right? Just because you work from home doesn't mean you can be unprofessional, doesn't mean it's not work. You know, you still have to put in lots of hours and a lot of effort on your part to make things work. But I think we're really just seeing that big change and that more companies are willing to explore these alternative working arrangements. And there are more people who are almost demanding them as far as what they want out of their careers.
Yeah, that's a really good approach. And it's a really good message to, I think, get out there and educate people a lot more on. I mean, there's a couple of points it raises for me. Certainly when I was in the corporate world and I had an international role that involved multiple locations. So I was actually quite used to working from home and working remotely because of the time differences involved. So it wasn't practical to go into the office at midnight, for example, to do teleconferences. Or the other thing that I think today is helping to tap into a great resource that's been underutilized in the past. And that's, young families, for example, young mothers that are stay-at-home mums with babies and young kids, and they don't want to go into an office in a 9-to-5 job, but they certainly have time on their hands where they could productively do something working from home and at the same time still be there for their family.
Absolutely. And I think we have more people thinking about a career that's best suited to them and their passions, and also more mindful of some of the environmental impacts of commuting. You know, if you've ever lived outside of a city and had to drive into the traffic to get, you know, downtown, that can take a couple of hours out of your day. That's just sort of lost time. Like you mentioned, you're not spending it with your family. It's very frustrating. It's not good for the environment. And so I think a lot more people are thinking about, how do I set up that career that works around the way I want my life to work, you know, whether that's having a flexible schedule, whether that's being able to work with a variety of people at different times as a freelancer, or whether that's just, you know, being at home and enjoying that environment and not having to commute or deal with, you know, in-office politics or challenges.
Yeah. Well, you've raised quite a few things there that would scare a lot of people away from the traditional corporate world, and particularly the politics. But I remember back to the time I was traveling throughout Asia, and some of the big cities in Asia, people were commuting 3 and 4 hours one way. So that, you know, if you work that out, it'd be like 6 to 8 hours of commuting in public transport, or sometimes in cars, which was even worse. And as you say, they didn't have that time with their family. Their whole life was basically just work, travel, eat and sleep.
Yeah. And I think people don't want that anymore, or they at least want to explore the options that might be different. And now that we have great tools like video conferencing, like online platforms, there's often not a need for a lot of companies. They're starting to question, hey, do we even need this office? Do we need to have people driving into an office, this extra expense we're paying for? Or could we be just as or more productive if our team was distributed and working remotely? And then we could work with the best talent all around the world, rather than being limited to who happens to live in your geographic area willing to relocate there.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, I could go on talking these topics for ages, but I'm aware of the time. So I think it's a good point to move on, Laura, to our buzz round, which is our innovation round designed to help our audience, who are primarily leaders and innovators in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got 5 questions, and hopefully you'll give us some insightful answers that'll inspire people to go and do something awesome today.
Wonderful.
Yeah. What do you think is the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Always be questioning everything you're doing and thinking, is there a different way I can go about this? Is this the most effective way? Is this the most enjoyable way? So always be questioning and be sort of self-reflective.
Yeah, I love that, and particularly the enjoyable part as well, because I think that comes back to the motivation part. If there's something that needs to be done, and whilst you can look at efficiency and effectiveness, if you add the enjoyment part, then you're motivated to really do it.
Exactly.
What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I have forced myself to get out of the house and interact with other people in my industry. I've really tried to focus on connection over the last year or two. And it's good to get out of your environment, number one, because you start thinking more creatively and innovatively. But also sometimes it's some other person who's having a conversation and it sparks an idea in you to do something. So for me, it's about, you know, finding my tribe of people. Where are they at? How can we interact? And kind of going from there.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I was having a conversation yesterday with a group of people around the challenges of working from home. And there was the majority of the people in the conversation felt as though that there were too many distractions at home and that they really missed that connection part with other people. And I'm kind of on the other end of that spectrum because I'm very much an introvert. So I'm like you, I've got to say, okay, I'm really disciplined in working from home. I can do that and I can kind of get in my own room and be on my own and get a whole lot of things done, but I've got to get out and talk to people to kind of get a, see a different environment and get some different stimulations.
I think that's important for us introverts. We have to know that we can't always be in our own little world. And so even though you question it as you're about to go into these meetings or networking events, you're like, okay, I'm going to be better for this. I don't have to do it that often. I can do it.
All right. Now, what's a favorite resource of yours that you use a lot?
I would say, I was just talking about this with someone earlier. I use a time tracking tool called Toggle, and it just helps me see how I'm spending my time. It makes me be more mindful of it. So I have to start and stop the timer manually to say, oh, I'm working on writing a book today, or I'm doing administrative work. And then it kind of gives me a weekly report of, you know, how much time I'm spending doing certain things. And I use that to monitor, oh, wow, I spent 12 hours on admin. I need to hire somebody else to help with that. Or, oh, I'm really slacking on, you know, my personal finances. I've been neglecting that and didn't log any hours there. It's time to build that back in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great resource to kind of get an idea of where you're spending time. And also if, I mean, you have to be really disciplined to do that, but if you're getting distracted by other stuff rather than focusing a lot of time and energy on the key things, then that'll highlight that as well, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
All right. Now, what's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
I think it's to take that bigger project and break it down into different pieces. So even when a client assigns me what would seem like a small project, maybe one blog, I'm going to break that down into three phases: research, writing, and editing. Those are all different. They're distinct tasks. I don't do them together. And so immediately when I get that project, I block it on my calendar. Maybe Monday is research, Tuesday is writing, Wednesday is editing and turning it in. And so that way I always know that I'm, you know, not waiting until the last minute to work on a project and not dropping the ball anywhere or making mistakes.
Yeah, that's, I really love that because it kind of means that it's less overwhelming and it's what's the next step I can do, which might be research, or if you've done the research, it's writing, and then blocking it out on the calendar is another great tip.
Yes. And sometimes I found too that, you know, you have a resistance, internal resistance. If I say, you know, write 10,000 page or 10,000 words in my next book, if I put that on my to-do list, I'm just not going to feel motivated to do that. But if I say write 500 words and I put that maybe in my calendar a couple of times throughout the week, I'm much more likely to complete it and it doesn't feel as overwhelming. So even if you feel that lack of momentum, you can say, you know what, I can do just the research for this client piece. That's only going to take me 30 minutes. I can do just that. I don't have to do any more. And so I think that makes it feel a little more achievable.
Yeah, great advice. All right. And what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
It's really just to know who you are, right? And to recognize that not everyone will like you or want to work with you. You know, I mentioned earlier that I'm a fast talker. Obviously, anyone listening to this has heard that. So there will be people who will say, wow, she talks way too fast. I can't keep up with that. And that's fine, right? Because the people who do like that will gravitate towards me and the ones who don't will gravitate away. So be willing to embrace your strengths and your weaknesses, whatever they might be.
Yeah, I love that. So self-awareness is really important. Yeah. And as you say, people who don't like something about you are probably not a good match to work with. And
right. And they'll honestly feel grateful to have known that up front. Mm. So I like to be very open about the things that people either do or don't like about working with me, because I want people to feel confident that this is the right or it's the wrong decision for them, and they've saved themselves, you know, frustration and money spent that wasn't the right fit.
Mm. All right. Now, where can people reach out and learn more about you and your work and the book, of course, and even perhaps reach out and say thank you for what you've shared today, Laura?
Sure. So my website is betterbizacademy.com, and you'll see all my free resources there. And then under the free resources tab is my podcast as well. So you can check that out if you have any interest in freelancing.
Great. And we'll post links to those in the show notes so that people can click through and find out more.
Great.
Now, do you have a kind of a parting piece of advice you'd like to leave our listener for their business, particularly if they want to be a leader in their field or in innovation?
Sure. Recognize that you cannot do it all yourself. Even if up until now you've been able to, you have to be able to hire other people. Even if they're not full-time employees, you need other people to help you get things done. It's been instrumental to help me scale my business. And people often remark that they see my marketing material everywhere. That is not me. That is my team of amazing virtual assistants who are working behind the scenes to help make sure that my brand is out there. And so you might have some bumps along the way, hire the wrong people, not know how to outsource at first, but you will eventually figure it out and get those, you know, gold star team members that are worth keeping around for a long time.
Yeah, that's wonderful advice. And I think that it's probably one of the secrets to scaling a business and keeping a sustainable business, really.
Yes, you can't do it all yourself. Even if you've been able to do it for a while, you will eventually burn out.
Yeah. And we talked earlier about constructing a business or having a business that allows you to live a lifestyle that you choose to live or that you want to live or that you love. And that's the way to do it. Otherwise, you end up having a business that runs your life.
Yes, so true.
Hmm. All right. Well, finally then, Laura, who would you like me to chat with on a future Innova Buzz podcast and why?
So I am going to recommend a colleague of mine named Michael Vann. He just published a book with a really interesting perspective on selling businesses. It's called Buying Out the Boss, and it's specific advice for people who are buying a business or selling a business to someone they know. So you might think it's easier to buy or sell to someone you know, but those pathways are fraught with obstacles. And so him and his father have been working in that field for 50 years and have a lot of experience helping transition businesses to the next generation, whether it's a family member or key employee, when all the parties at the table know each other. So I'd really recommend checking him out.
Okay. Well, that sounds fascinating. So we'll get an introduction from you to Michael and get him on the podcast to have a conversation around that. So it sounds like a really niched but fascinating topic that's probably got a whole lot of potholes that people may not realize.
Exactly. Yeah.
Hmm. All right. Well, thanks very much for sharing your time and your insights so generously with us today on the Innova Buzz podcast, Laura. I've really enjoyed this and I've learned a lot, and there's been lots of wonderful tips that you've shared today. So I'm sure that there'll be some golden nuggets for everyone to take away. So I wish you all the best for the future and let's keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that engaging and informative conversation with Laura and took something away from her episode. She shared so many tips about building a freelance business that apply to all businesses. My favorite theme was around building a business to support your lifestyle, rather than the other way around, and doing work you enjoy. I'd love to know what you took away from Laura's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Laura Briggs. That is LauraBriggs. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Laura Briggs. You'll also find contact information there for getting in touch with Laura, as well as links to the Better Biz Academy website, to her book, Start Your Own Freelance Writing Business, and the other resources we spoke about in the conversation.
Laura suggested that we have a conversation with Michael Vann, author of Buying Out the Boss, on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So, Michael, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Laura Briggs. Remember to check out our Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without giving away your email. But most importantly, in less than 30 minutes, you'll gain absolute clarity about your ideal client and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. And if you'd like our help to go even deeper into marketing mastery or our help with podcast production, then send me an email to jurgen@innovabiz.co and we'll set up a quick call just to have a chat, get to know one another and find out if we're indeed a good fit. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got some more fantastic guests lined up, including Greg Rollett of the Ambitious Media Group and Mark Robinson from the International Academy of Wealth. Stay connected with us by subscribing to the InnovaBuzz podcast at innovabuzz.com/subscribe, innovabuzz.com/subscribe. Make sure you never miss another episode. It would also mean a lot to me if you leave us a review, because what you think matters. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your ideas, your suggestions, or questions you have, so go ahead and share them in the comments below the blog post for this episode. Until next time, I'm Jurgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.